Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 20, delivered on April 12, 2012. The title of this lecture is Marginal Revenue Product and Marginal Factor Cost.
Today, Marginal Revenue Product and Marginal Factor Cost. As I had mentioned earlier, this is the last of the robust quantitative lectures. There is a point to this lecture that has to do with employment of factors of production. We can talk about, as we have in the past, we've talked about, and I've given lectures on competitive versus monopolized or concentrated markets. Competitive markets produce a higher output at a lower prevailing price in the market, all other things being equal, than would concentrated markets. That's why we have laws that were passed, especially in the earlier part of the 20th century, trying to stop the growth of monopolies and trying to keep industries from getting unduly concentrated with a few powerful companies and then all the other companies sort of bringing up the rear. We want that to not happen simply because we have lower output levels and then higher prices in these concentrated or monopolized markets. And as I had mentioned previously, if there is less product being produced, then there are fewer factors of production being employed to produce that. In other words, in terms of you and me, in an industry where there are not many competitors, that simply means that there won't be as high an employment level as there would be if there were lots of competitors. It's just the way it is. The other side of the market is you as the suppliers of labor. You're a factor of production, labor, human capital. We kind of lump that all under labor. But one way or the other, you are the supply side of the production market. You are one of the supply sides of the production market. Now, in that case, now under that understanding, we could talk about whether this is a concentrated market on the supply side or not. In other words, are there few of you who can perform a task, or are there many of you who can perform the task? Now, here's the deal. And I brought this up earlier in the course, but I want to come back to it now. Draw a couple of supply curves here. If we're talking about dumb work, menial work, everyone on Earth, or almost everyone, could do it. Absent a few people who are severely disabled. If it is really dumb work, just muscles or just the routine idiot kind of stuff, anyone in the world can do that kind of work. And therefore, if I were to talk about the supply of labor in one of these markets where there is just no skill required whatsoever, the supply of labor would be perfectly elastic for unskilled labor. The prevailing with labor on the horizontal axis and the wage rate on the vertical axis, the wage that would be paid would be a subsistence wage, just enough to keep the people alive. Because if we hire, if I as a business person hire one of you, I don't dent the market. There are so many more of you, I don't have to pay a higher wage to get another worker. It's just that it's so easy to hire workers that you will all take a minimum or a subsistence wage. That's why you're here in college, is because you don't want that to happen. You want to have some way that you have a lever so that if a business hires one of you with this set of skills, the next time there aren't going to be as many of you, noticeably not as many, so I'll have to pay a higher wage to command more of you. I will have to bring the wage up and up in order to induce you to come to this market. So we could say, okay, with a basic set of skills and some intelligence, maybe a high school diploma and a little bit of college, we would see the labor supply curve begin to have a little bit of, to be a little bit less elastic. The supply of labor curve would begin to rise a little bit. So that what we are depicting there is that if the business wants to hire labor L1, it would pay wage 1, but in order to induce more people to come to that market with that set of skills, I would have to provide a better wage, W2. And if I needed more workers, I'd have to give more incentive. Because it's not just dumb work. People would have to get some learnings, be a little more intelligent than your average idiot. So in order to get people to do this kind of work, I would have to bring the wage up to induce people to go to stay in school, to get a little college education, not to be dumbbells. Now, if we're talking about more skill, requiring a college degree, requiring good grades, requiring intelligence of thought, requiring a better, being a little bit less crazy, disciplining yourself for study, for your life, and all that, maybe, we would then see a labor supply curve that was more inelastic, steeper, representing the simple idea that if I want to get more people to deliver their work product to the market, I will have to steepen the wage, give a more substantial wage. And you'll see that in this kind of a market, in order to induce up to L3, for example, I have to really begin to jack that wage. It's an obviously simple idea. If I need people who can have good, strong math skills, write complete grammatically correct sentences, and generally use their brains instead of their butts to think through problems at the workplace, I'm going to have to pay them something to do that. They're not going to do it unless I pay them something for their time. 2 years, 4 years of college, you're giving up what you could have made working at a lower end job. You're giving up something, so in order for me to be able to get you to do that, I have to be able to offer you something in return, a good wage. If we're talking about a master's degree or a PhD, that requires a lot of time out of your life, sacrifices in your life, and it requires that you give up a lot of money that you could have made along the way. So I would have to make the curve even steeper. That's the reason you're in college. You're not here for your health, for your general well-being. The hell with that. You are trying to get off this. You see, you'll always be able to work dumb. You'll always be able to do a job like a McDonald's, although that's more skill than it used to be. You'll always be able to go out and work in a field. We're all part of this labor supply curve that's perfectly elastic. But fewer and fewer of us are in these steeper and steeper labor supply curves as you go up the line. That's the point of education. That's the point of training. That's the point of learning. That's the point of living a disciplined life in terms of thinking instead of playing video games your whole life. There's a rare instance, and I don't know that I brought this up, but there's, you see, through great effort, you can move yourself so that you participate in steeper and steeper supply curves. So, for example, anyone can do this stupid work. I can hire as many of you as I want at a prevailing subsistence wage, just enough to keep you alive. And if you don't like it, I'll just get rid of you and hire someone else because there's so many of you out there. But then with more work, you can, with learning and education and also developing skills in other ways, you can participate in this one as well as this one. Working harder, you can participate in this one, maybe with a high-powered bachelor's degree in math or chemistry or physics or something like that. You can participate in this one. But you could always still participate in this one, you know, with some using lower skills, and you could always participate in this one. So always as you go up the line, you still belong to these lower curves, these higher elasticity curves. There is a place, though, where you'll see the rare instance of a labor supply curve that is perfectly inelastic. In other words, it's perfectly vertical. It's highly, highly unusual, but you've seen it in your lives. This is a labor supply curve where essentially there is one or a few people who can deliver this kind of work, but there are no more. No one else could do it, no matter how high the wage is. You'll get people who will try, but they won't have the perfectly substitutable skill set. This one is almost always the result of some native, innate ability that can't be learned. It can be developed and enhanced, but it cannot be learned. In sports, for example, there have been athletes who just could not ever be replaced. They just had a skill set that was, it just wasn't anyone else's skill set. I wish I could think of, really, in the modern age, right now, in basketball. Now, historically, you would have had a Jordan, or, I don't know, there were others in that time, too. So, yeah, Jabbar, maybe John Bird, some of those guys. I don't know if there would be anyone who would be that beyond everyone else. In golf, for many years, there was Tiger Woods. He could just do it, and that was it. There was no one who could beat him. Then that went away. Sometimes this is a transitory skill. In other sports, football, the modern era, I honestly would have said in an earlier era, a Simpson would have been one of those. You just saw him. He was beyond everyone else. Who?
Namath,
but that was mainly because he did these commercials wearing pantyhose. That was scary to me. I was growing up, and that really confused my gender identity. I'm trying to think if there were others. Maybe a Bart Starr or some of those other ones that came out of that era. But in the modern era, I'm trying to think, is there anyone who is just so beyond everyone else? honestly, in your time, you don't see it in sports that much because there are so many people who are really, really talented, but you don't see that thing that is just unbelievable. In, I believe it was the 1976 Olympics, in the gymnastics competition, every time you see these, usually young girls in the age range of 9 to 14 who can just do amazing things. But in the 1976 Olympics, there was a gymnast. Her name was Nadia Comaneci. And she was the first and I believe the last of the gymnasts who scored a perfect 10 in a in the double bar routine. And they played it over and over again on television afterwards. And you could see it was perfect. No one had ever done it before. She couldn't do it again 2 years later because she had gone through puberty and her body had changed. But in that moment, she was no one else. She was like no one else who had ever done it before or who has ever done it since. So there's an example too. Now, in the realm of entertainment in general, once in a while you'll see something that is just no one else can do it. In the 30s, you could have said a Harry Houdini was beyond anyone else in his time, and there were some awesome magicians in his time. In terms of music and singing, I'm probably a Streisand. Now, speaking from an earlier era when I had seen her, when she was on her game, she could bring down a theater like no one else in the world could. In the modern era, in terms of bands, there was just something about the Beatles. Maybe Floyd. In the modern era, who would be just beyond anyone else? I'll tell you, to be honest, in a Floyd concert back when they weren't elderly, I mean, it was just like you saw this is beyond belief. Saw Jackson once, Michael Jackson. There was no one. I mean, yeah, there was the flash and the fire and all that kind of stuff, but at the core of it, there was a messed up young man, as messed up as he was talented beyond anyone else. No one else could do it. That's what I'm referring to with this supply curve that's perfectly inelastic. It would be something where it goes beyond just education and training. People can bust their asses for years in terms of orchestral musicians. I've known some who have, their parents have beaten them into the ground from the time they were like 2-3 years old. They got to the point where they were incredible musicians. But I know this one example, this girl, she just tried so hard. And she went to this competition in Hamburg. And she just left, and she was just a broken woman, because she was so good. She had spent so many hours. But she went there and she saw these pianists who were, it was beyond practice. It was beyond learning all the things. They just had a magic. And she actually got some piercings when she got back to the state. Rebellion, as I recall. But yeah, once in a while. Here we go. None of us have this curve. None of us have it. Well, maybe there's something that you have that's unexplored, but this one's a special one. I just wanted to bring that up. It's a curiosity that people can strive greatly, become incredible. In academia, I know math people who study, they bust their asses, they get PhDs, they publish incredible works. They just don't have that magic that every once in a while through history, you've seen someone who had the magic. It was just like they saw the entire universe and it wasn't a problem for them. Assholes. But anyway,
That doesn't mean they're particularly likable people. Don't get me wrong about that. These people who have these incredible talents and geniuses that are just native to them tend to be some of the most effed up people I've ever met in my life. So be happy you don't have that. Otherwise, the only friends you'd have are the ones who want your money. Where the hell was I? Okay. Here's the thing, though. About both of the sides of the market, you can have a on the demand for labor side, that would be the business side. On the demand for labor side, that would be the businesses that hire workers. You could have a competitive market, or you could have a non-competitive market. In other words, you could have a market where there are many companies fiercely competing against each other. So output is higher, prices are lower. Or you could have a market where you are trying to find a job in an industry where it's quite quite concentrated. There aren't a few many companies. The companies out there charge higher prices because they produce overall a lower output. So that's on the demand for labor side, the business side. Now, on your side, the supply of labor side, you could have a market that is either competitive. In other words, it's something where there are not a lot of skills required, and there are many, many, many workers who can do the stuff, do it. Or you could have a less competitive, we could say a non-competitive market, where there are barriers that keep lots and lots of people from joining in this market. So essentially you have a grid where the supply and the demand interact in such a way that you will have two different sets of forces that would create the conditions for employment and the wages that would be paid. Now, on the demand side, this is businesses hiring workers. Supply of labor, this is you, the workers. Okay? It gets kind of confusing. You don't tend to think of yourself as a supplier, as a person, but you are most decidedly one of the most important suppliers throughout history. You, the workers. I'll get back to that in the last lecture of this semester. The fundamentally most important thing in all of history in terms of business has been the supply of labor. Throughout history, from the first time that organized enterprise came about and needed people to do stuff, to today, billions of you are hired every year and fired. The question is, how important are you? How central are you to the functioning of a world and a world of enterprise and production? You are the most important thing. And I'll get back to that again in the last lecture. But for now, the question boils down to this. Okay, which one of these four slots would we see the highest employment rates? Is there some pattern? Are a couple of the slots showing more employment than a couple of the other slots? The answer is yes. And it might surprise you. You see, because let me talk about this supply of labor side. See this competitive labor side? Well, okay, well, let me go back here. This is repeating myself. But on the demand for labor side, the business owner side, that is competitive, lots and lots of companies versus concentrated industries, not many companies. That's on the business side. Now, on the supply side, we have competitive labor markets where lots and lots of people have the skills necessary for the job. So they fight with each other quite a bit for the jobs. In a non-competitive market, that can come about through just, it's something where a lot of education or skill or knowledge is needed. It could also come about through unions. Unions do what they have to suppress employment, the availability of workers. That's the whole point of a union, is to control the supply of labor to make it more expensive for the businesses to hire. And it's not just labor unions. It's all over the place. For example, have you ever thought about being a doctor? It's actually kind of cool, you know. You get to cut people open and tell people to take their clothes off, and then you can laugh at them. It's really, really sweet. But you see, have you heard that getting a medical degree is really, really hard? Yeah. And then after you get your medical degree, you have to do your internship, where they treat you like an animal for several years, and then after that you have to do a residency where they still treat you like an animal, and then after that you might live long enough to be a doctor. One of my students from long ago gave me the horror story. She went on to medical school. She described medical school was just really hard, but she liked it. And then she went to her internship. She was in the hospital, she said, 6 days a week. She would catch maybe an hour of sleep in a dark room in a closet before someone would kick her awake and tell her that she needed to get back on her schedule and check patients. She said she has no idea. She doesn't remember most of it. She probably did many things wrong. Patients might have died, but that was what it was. It was hazing. It was intended to deter people from getting into that kind of work. And even in PhD programs, I've seen many where, I mean, there was hazing going on. They just drove people out. Not because the material was so hard, but they were assholes. They treated people like dirt in these programs. Made your life miserable. And that, so you can talk about unions as a way to create non-competitive labor markets, but there are many other ways too. There are ways that make it very hard to get into some kind of industry as a worker, just through licenses, certifications, costs of entry. All those things can create non-competitive labor supply. Okay, so it's not just unions, but we can use unions as sort of an example of when a market becomes, for labor, becomes non-competitive by restricting the number of workers who can participate in the labor supply curve. Okay, that sets up everything. Now comes the problem. There is a problem that the businesses face. There are two problems that the businesses face when they hire workers. The first problem goes back to something I showed you earlier in the semester, the law of diminishing marginal productivity. Every extra worker I hire will produce less extra output than the last worker. That's a law of nature. It's not some defect in workers, it's just a law of nature. Remember those tables I showed you? As more people were hired to pick the tomatoes out of the field, you got less and less extra output. Even though total productivity was going up, less and less extra product was coming out of the fields. What that means is that if I'm hiring people, at best, I've got to pay each extra worker the same as the last worker, in the best case scenario.
Which means that if I hire you at $10 an hour and you can produce 100 units of output, I'll have to hire you at $10 an hour afterwards, but I know you won't produce as much as she did because of the law of diminishing marginal productivity. I can take a whip to you, beat you, and make you call me daddy, but it's still not going to change the law of diminishing marginal productivity. I will have to pay you the same as you. So in at the bottom line, the amount you produce is less, so I am paying you more per unit of output. That is going to drive my decision-making framework. Now, if I'm a monopoly, it's even worse because as I produce more, I'm facing a full demand curve sloping downward. So when you produce more, if it's a monopoly, when you produce more, not only are you going to produce less than you did, but I can't even charge as much for what I sell your product for because yours would be in addition to hers and I would be down farther on the demand curve for the product. That's a little complicated. I'll get back. You'll see it in the table again. But here's another problem. Here's another problem. Marginal factor cost. Here's how, and I put this in a nutshell. I try not to be too quantitative. You'll see it in the table very evidently what's happening. But in human terms, it is a very real phenomenon. And I'll tell you where you'll see it if you haven't already seen it. Look, I'm going to have to hire someone for a job. I've got this. It's a skill set that's not very common. And I know that in this market here, you see, there are probably 5 people who could do this job. So my labor supply curve comprises 5 people who all have the skill set. So I put the ad in the paper. And one of the 5, I need this a worker. It's a manager for my office, needs a very special skill set. And it's the first worker. So, okay, I hire you for that job. I got 5 resumes. Okay, I'll hire you. So I had 5 people available, and so I can pay you, okay, I'll pay you $30,000 a year. You take the job. Now, there are 4 people left in the market. Remember that. In a year, my company's grown, and I'm going to need another person with the same skill set. So, okay, but remember now there are only 4 of you in the market, which means that the market is tighter than when I hired you. So, with 4 people in the market, I get 4 resumes, and okay, 4 resumes, I'm going to have to pay you more because you obviously, it's not as easy as it was. Okay, $35,000 a year. The first thing that's going to happen is you're going to pitch a bitch fit because I'm paying you $30,000 for the same work I'm paying you $35,000 for. Well, he's going to say, all right, if you don't pay me what you're paying her, I quit. And at first I say, well, fine, you son of a bitch, you ungrateful dog. I'll just put the ad in the paper and hire another one. So you walk away and I put the ad in the paper. How many resumes am I going to get? 4. What's the prevailing salary for 4? It's 35. So whether I give you 35 and keep you or fire you and hire one of the 4, you're back in the pool, I'm still going to pay you, the first worker, what I paid the second worker. Do you see it? Okay, now, okay, my business has grown. I'm going to have to hire a third manager with the same skill set. Okay, wait a minute. There are only 3 resumes coming in. Okay, so now in this case, I'm going to hire you. But with three, I have to pay you more than I paid when I had to hire from a pool of four, so I pay you 40. Both of you throw a bitch fit at me. You quit. I'm not working unless you give me 40. And I say, fine, leave. And I put an ad in the paper, but when I get resumes in, how many will I get? Well, I'll get yours too, yeah. No, yes, yeah, I will. You need the work. Don't tell me you know, don't like it working there. I let you have a coffee break every 2 days. You see what's happening? I'm going to have to pay both of these people $40,000 because I paid you $40,000. What this means, at the bottom line, is that the labor supply curve is no longer my relevant curve for deciding on hiring. You see, because the labor supply curve is a marginal cost curve. You see, and as such, all a labor supply curve measures is the cost of the last worker at any given point. So this labor supply curve, one worker, 30, two workers, 35, three workers, 40. That's what a labor supply curve shows me. But that's not what I'm facing as a business. I'm facing that every extra worker I hire means the worker before costs me more. So instead of the labor supply curve, one, yeah, 30. But two, the second worker makes the first worker cost me $5,000 more. So the total marginal factor cost of the second worker is higher. And the third one is even worse because that third one creates a backwash effect on two workers. The fourth one will create a backwash effect on three workers. So ultimately, what happens is that my decision-making calculus is not on the supply of labor curve, it's on what we call the marginal factor cost of labor curve. Because every time I hire another worker, it creates more costs for all of the workers I've already hired. MFC. Okay, now the only place this wouldn't happen is if I'm hiring unskilled workers, since I'm hiring each extra one at the same cost as the last one. So here's the interesting thing. If I have a perfectly elastic labor supply curve, the marginal factor cost of labor curve is actually there, but it is sitting right on the labor supply curve. But as soon as that labor supply curve begins to kick upward, that marginal factor cost curve, like a shadow, begins to show up above it. We see this in economics. You might remember that there was, when I did the marginal revenue curve, if it was a perfectly competitive company, the marginal revenue was right on the price demand line. But as soon as you started talking about monopoly, that demand curve slipped downward, and then this marginal revenue curve began to come off it underneath. You remember when that happened? Look at this, the same thing. It's funny because this it was only in grad school that this began to hit me, that it's like these marginal curves are hiding underneath curves. And once you stop talking about perfect condition, perfect competition or all that, or perfectly competitive labor markets, all of a sudden these shadow curves start to emerge like a light. You're turning it a different way, and suddenly a curve begins to come off it. If it's a demand curve shifting downward, the shadow comes off it downward. If it's a supply curve and it kicks upward, the shadow comes off it on the top side. Like I said, this was something I didn't even really... It didn't occur to me that this was what was going on until I was in grad school and I just looked at the curves. Oh, these are like shadows coming up off them. They hide when the curves are perfectly flat, but then as soon as the curve drops downward, off comes the shadow that way. If a curve kicks upward, off comes the shadow that way. Now, let me tell you the upshot of this. If you haven't seen it already, you will see it in your life. What was happening here was I hired you at 35 when you were at 30. I, as a business person, I would love to think of a way to keep you from bitching and still pay you $30,000. Here's how businesses do it. And I don't know if any of you have seen it yet, But here's how they do it. You are not to discuss your salary with anyone else in the company. It's a privacy matter.
And I have to sign right here.
You better believe it. Have any of you seen that yet? You're not allowed to disclose your salary. Oh, it's a privacy matter. Bullshit! It's the marginal factor cost of labor curve. They're trying to keep you from finding out what you make. I know this one. I've seen it myself. Matter of fact, the funny story was this happened three years ago, and then last year, two brothers graduated, same degree, pretty much the same GPA. They both got jobs at a company here in town. I won't mention its name. The kid who graduated in, was it 07 or 08? No, it was 08. He went to work for the company, and they tell me their salary. A lot of them, I'm bold. I'll just say, what did they offer you? He went in there at $48,000 a year. His brother, younger brother, graduated. No, it was in 2011. Graduated in 2011. Went to work, same company, same department. They thought it was so cool. Bros, you know, they'd always been very close. He told me he was pulling $56,000. And I thought to myself, you know what, I wonder if his brother knows. Then it occurred to me, though, this company is very strict. You do not discuss your salary with anyone else. If his older brother had found out, because the labor market for this particular skill set of quantitative business skills was getting pretty tight. Not a lot of kids were graduating the last couple of years with the degree and with the coursework. And so the labor market was tighter. They hired his younger brother at a higher wage than they hired him. But they made sure that he knew, privacy matter, you can't discuss your salary with anyone. And as you said, you sign that you're not going to. That was exactly, it was exactly this marginal factor cost of labor. They didn't want the older brother to know what the younger brother made, because then the older brother would piss his pants, walk away, and they'd have to hire someone new in a labor market that was quite a bit tighter when they hired the older brother. So there you are. This actually exists in the real world. Businesses know it exists, and they try to thwart the marginal factor cost of labor effect, which would make all of their costs go up. In the long run, those efforts usually don't work, because the workers will figure out that scuttlebutt gets around, and they'll just simply say, you know, you got to pay me more, or I'm just going to quit here and I'll just jump to a new job. Well, what about loyalty? Screw loyalty these days. Companies seem to be very upset about lack of loyalty after they've done their third or fourth layoff of workers. Here's what I'm going to show you now. I'm going to hand out a paper, and we'll pick this back up on Thursday. I don't want to hammer too much at you at once, but we're going to start this out a little bit here. Okay. Now, these printed really sucky. Okay. Set it for the price-taking firm and competitive. So when you set it down, I will try to have it so that the top page is the right page. And it's printed in such a way that I'm convinced that machine blows cracks some nights when no one's around. But here you go. And I will put up a PDF of this on my website so that you'll have, if you want to just be messy with this, you'll have another one at hcc-prof.com in the scrolling marquee. I'll put up an extra picture of this for you, an extra document so that you can, like I said, be kind of messy with this one if you want. And as you can see, I have completed a couple of rows of this for you. Now, those four tables there represent this grid. Price taking, competitive, price seeking, competitive, price taking, non-competitive, price seeking, non-competitive. It's this grid. I use a slightly different terminology base in there, but it's that grid that I've got right up there. Now, here's the deal with doing this. It is not as big as you think, as it looks, because you just keep repeating the numbers from table to table. So, for example, once you got the numbers for a price-taking firm, you can put those numbers, those same numbers will go in for the other table that's a price-taking firm. And for the competitive factor market, you can put those same numbers in on the factor side, on the right side of the table, for the other table that has that competitive factor market. So it's not nearly as tough as it looks as far as doing the work goes. And I've completed a number of the three rows on each of the tables so that you'll know how to get yourself started. And we'll go through this in detail on Thursday. But to get you started on what you're doing in the table, and the formula will stay the same for each column. The formula will be the same from table to table. And all you'll be doing is applying the formula to slightly different numbers. In the first table, price-taking firm and a competitive factor market. In other words, we're talking about perfect competition going in, perfect competition going out. So you can see the perfect competition of the output market because the price stays the same. This company can produce and sell as much as it wants at the prevailing price of $1 per unit. In other words, it's not like a monopoly where it's facing a downward sloping demand curve. It can just produce and sell as much as it wants at a buck. Notice that intervening, that second column, though. In the second column, we are showing how much the first column. This is not the way in tables we've done before. In the first column, we are talking about how many workers you hire. So we go from 0 to 1 to 2 on up the grinder. And in the second column, we show how much output total is being created by the number of workers we hire. So when we hired one worker, that's column one. We got 20 total units of output. When we hired two workers, we got 39 total units of output. When we hire three workers, we get 57. And on down the line, you can see the total output. Now, if you wanted to go over to column 6. Column 6 is the marginal product. So in other words, if two workers produce 39 units of output and one worker produces 20, then that second worker produced 19 extra units of output. Do you see that? Look, two workers made a total of 39 units. One worker made a total of 20 units. That means that second worker added 19 extra units of output. Three workers made a total of 57 units. Two workers made a total of 39 units. So that third worker must have produced 57 minus 39, or 18 units of output. So you can actually fill in that sixth column, marginal physical product, very quickly. And it'll be the same number in every one of the tables. Do you follow that? Let me make sure you're okay with that. The best way to do these tables is sort of to find the things that are going to be the same from one place to another. Now, if we go down and look through here on the company side, your price, the company can charge $1 a unit. It's perfectly competitive, so no matter how much it makes, it's not deading the market at all. It can sell as much as it wants at a buck a unit. So those total revenues, column 4, will be your total physical product times the average price per unit of output at that level of production. So for one worker makes 20 units, the company will bring in 20 times $1, or 20 bucks. Total revenue, column 4, will be column 2 times column 3. Again, column 4 is column 2 times column 3. Two workers make 39 units, and you can sell those at an average price per unit of a buck. So 39 units at a dollar a unit means the company pulls into the cash drawer 39 times 1. 3 units, 57 units are made, a dollar a unit. 57 times a dollar is $57. Column 4 is column 2 times column 3. I hope you're beginning to see that actually this isn't hard. You just have to it's arithmetic. You just have to know what to do with each number. I mean, if you saw these columns on their own, you probably could figure it out. It's just all together, it's kind of overwhelming a little bit. So you see how to make all those columns? Now let's go over to that seventh column, marginal revenue per unit sold. All that is just your marginal revenue. Two workers brought in, we have to do column 5 there. Column 5, two workers brought in a total of $39. One worker brought into the cash drawer $20. So the second worker must have brought in 19 extra dollars. Three workers brought a total revenue to the company of $57. Two workers brought total revenue to the company of $39. So that third worker must have brought into the cash drawer 18 extra dollars. Do you see it? Now the last column, okay, all you do for the last column is say that, for the first worker, he brought in an extra $20. He made an extra 20 units. So if I take column 5 divided by column 2, I see that guy... Oh, I'm sorry. It's column six divided by column 5. Column 6. I'm saying things wrong here. The first worker brought in $20 extra, making 20 extra units. So he brought in per unit 20 divided by 20. Column 5 divided by column 6. He brought in a dollar. The second worker brought in an extra $19 and produced 19 extra units. So that second worker brought in per unit 19 extra dollars divided by 19 extra units. That's a dollar. The third worker brought in an extra $18, making 18 extra units. So that third worker brought in 8 per unit, 18 extra dollars divided by 18 extra units, or a buck. Now you can try to finish up the left side of each of the four tables. The formula will be identical. Now some of the patterns won't, this seventh column will not be the same, but a lot of the other will. And then we'll go on and do on Thursday, on Tuesday, we will do the other side, the factor market side. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.